Hello, and welcome to the Writers and Illustrators of the Future podcast. This is John Goodman, your host. This podcast is dedicated to the aspiring writer and artist and will provide inspiration and tips from top professionals in the field. If you've been listening to this podcast or are new to it, I thank you very much. I would also appreciate if you took a moment to follow it on whatever platform you use to listen to your podcasts. I'm currently at Superstars Writing Conference in Colorado Springs, and having a great time. The guest that I've got today is, it's interesting how that came a bit. I was just written to from the office a little bit ago saying, if you see him, find, you know, Kevin Eikenberry and see if you can get him on your podcast. I said, I just finished reading his book and I'm interviewing him in about an hour. And I said, oh, that's awesome. That was great. That was Julie Wills that said I should reach for you. So Kevin is the international bestselling author of the Protocol War series featuring Colorado Book Award finalist Sleeper Protocol, which publishes weekly called An Emotionally Powerful Debut, and the sequel Vendetta Protocol. Kevin is also the author of 9 bestselling Peacemaker novels in the Four Horsemen universe. And just yesterday, I interviewed Mark Stallings, who I interviewed talking about the Four Horsemen universe. So again, the world's shrinking a little bit here. And as well as he wrote that military science fiction novel, Runs in the Family, and the thriller Super Sync. Kevin has also contributed to the Nebula Award-nominated Kane Riordan series by Charles E. Gannon, who is also a guest on the podcast. And he's going to be sending his next book that we're going to interview him on prior to that release, and his alternate history novel, The Crossing, that he wrote in Eric Flint's universe, who was a first place winner several years ago, became a judge, and he recently passed. But this whole thing came to be, you know, I was like, wow, how small is this world? And then I read in his bio that he's a retired Army and managed a U.S. space camp, which was the precursor to the current Space Force. And both my wife and I are honorary commanders in the U.S. Space Force. So it was even more shrank down. So right now in the palm of my hand, I've got a brand new friend that has all these different connections. That's amazing. So welcome, Kevin.
Thank you very much, Sean. I'm glad to be here.
Absolutely. So before we get into talking about Sleeper Protocol and an amazing premise, you know, obviously deserving of awards. So you're in military and you're now a best-selling author and work in publishing. How did this all get started with you?
Well, I will tell you, I'm not one of those people that said at the age of 6 or 7, they wanted to be a writer.
Okay, good.
I never wanted to have a typewriter like Kevin J. Anderson or anything along those lines. But I was told in high school and then again in college that I was a good writer. And while I was in college, I pursued an English minor because I was going to go to law school. That was what I thought my dream job was going to be. So I did take creative writing and those types of things in college, but I did zero with that, except for write my master's thesis a couple years later. Fast forward to my years at space camp, of course, which is the program for kids to learn how to be astronauts, essentially in Huntsville, Alabama. While I was there, I was part of the Aviation Challenge portion, which is teaching kids how to be high-performance jet fighter pilots. And as part of our camp curriculum, I taught the high school age kids, and they always wanted to fly in the simulators against the counselors, do like the Top Gun thing.
Sure.
And so we decided that we would take things up a little notch. And so we created fictional characters and this fictional fighter squadron. And then it ended up where we actually wrote some little vignettes like intelligence dossiers about these pilots that these kids were going to fly against. And then in the course of into the ending of that summer in 1996 to the spring of 97, there were several different folks that wrote little stories using these characters. The whole idea was that it would be something that the kids could enjoy. And none of those will ever see the light of day because I think mine are terrible. But that was the first time I ever tried to do anything that was writing. Mm-hmm. And fast forward a few years from that, I was an Army reservist for my entire career. I was a captain at the time, and we were forward deployed just down to Fort Bliss, Texas to help get people out the door for Operation Enduring Freedom. And I actually went back and I looked at some of those stories and I thought, well, I could kludge these together and make a novel. And I did, and it will also never see the light of day because I think it's equally terrible. And so at that point, though, this was 2001, around 2002. And I just decided that was the end of the writing bug. Or so I thought. So a few years later, I worked with the Challenger Learning Center. So the astronauts' families from the Challenger accident in 1986 created learning centers all across.
And June Scobie Rogers, by the way, is a great friend. She is
a great friend of mine.
She was a keynote speaker at our event several years ago. So amazing. It just shrunk even more now.
So June and her family are very close friends. And so I was working with the Challenger Learning Centers at one in Arizona. And then I've been released from active duty to go set up one in Kansas. And while I was in Kansas, I had the opportunity to come down here and get involved with space operations. So that was kind of the tune from my military career towards space. And then the whole writing thing started to come along towards science fiction in a couple of years later. So I was called back to active duty in 2009 or about 2008. In 2008, I was called back to active duty because I had this background in space and space science education, and the Army was standing up space operations in the Army Reserve. And they asked me if I wanted to do that. And I said, yeah, that sounded like a lot of fun. So I went back on active duty to do so. But my first job was actually not a space job. Until they could actually create the job positions here in Colorado Springs, I had to go do something else for a little bit of time. So I ended up teaching ROTC. So I was teaching Army Reserve Officers Training Corps at Rose Holman Institute of Technology in Terre Haute, Indiana. It's a small private engineering school. We were also tied to Indiana State University and seven other different universities in Indiana. But a very, very prestigious university. They were one of the last ones in the country to actually get rid of the requirement for freshmen and sophomores to attend ROTC classes. They were a feeder for the Corps of Engineers for many years. But I've been there about a year, and about 4:30 on a Tuesday afternoon, I have a character start talking to me. And I have this idea, and I started writing notes. I always had a little notebook, so I started writing some notes. And about two pages into the notebook, I thought, this is a book. How do I write a book? And so being on a college campus, you know, I talked to my commander and I said, I want to take a college class. And he said, yeah, go for it. So I went back and took a creative writing class. And I turned in the first assignment. It comes back with two words on it. See me. That's either really good or really bad. So in this particular case, the instructor said, why aren't you published? And I had no clue. And so as part of my early training, if you will, as a writer, and while I was auditing this course, I had to write three short stories. And then I had to submit those to different markets and earn my rejection merit badge, as she called it.
Right.
And if I still thought that I wanted to do that after writing three stories and being rejected, then I might actually have something going and being a writer. And it turned out that I did. So I started writing short stories, and I think it was probably in maybe 2010 or 2011 was the first time I heard of the Writers of the Futures contest. And I didn't do anything with that knowledge either. I didn't think I was ready for it. And then I waited a couple of years and started to submit some stories. And I had a couple of honorable mentions before I did what's called proing out and sold my first novel. So
what an amazing story. That's super way cool. And even like I said, that palm of my hand got now it's a walnut size.
It is. It's a small world. You know, it really is.
Yeah, that's amazing. So we'll bounce. I mean, I'm just so many different questions, but a little bit now on Sleeper Protocol, because that's one thing I wanted. It's obviously won awards, but there's a reason for it's winning awards. And so I want to talk about that a little bit. How'd you come up? I guess first of all, give me your elevator pitch on it so people know what we're talking about before I start asking questions into it.
So Sleeper Protocol is a story of a soldier from our time who wakes up 300 years from now, but he has no identity. And he's given 1 year essentially to wander the world and figure out who he is. But at the same time, he also has to figure out if that future world is worth saving.
Absolutely. And it's interesting how in the future, he's got at the beginning for however long in the book, he doesn't know his name. Pronounce it Kieran?
Kieran, yes.
Yeah, so you got Kieran as he gets his memory and his experiences back together again, and when he goes to Australia and he saves that, or he doesn't say that, he rescues the one person, but he still dies, and that triggers all these other memories that keeps him going. And then Bennett, I guess she's the one that created the technology.
She's part of that group, yes.
Yeah, and going along fine till she decides to fall in love. Yep. And but that had to happen. That was inevitable.
You know? More or less.
But it's funny, the AI that's in his head having issues, not understanding, well, what's wrong with me, you know, with her.
Yeah.
What's wrong with me? You know, I don't have arms, but I still care.
Yeah.
You know, so that's funny, that an interesting love triangle concept type.
It really was. And it wasn't that the original manuscript that I put together did not have any of that with it, but it was also something where, you know, we've got a really, really strong group of local writers here in the Colorado Springs area. And I have a couple of friends that we sat down and we were trading story ideas and whatnot. And I just couldn't make this work. And then I figured out that I had the wrong antagonist. And so by making the AI essentially an antagonist, the book blew up from about a 40,000 word, you know, short novel to the 95,000 word novel that it was. And, you know, of course, then it sold and did all those other things. So yeah, it's a question of getting the right story elements together at the right time and making those right decisions.
Yeah, that was brilliant on that. So was there something that happened in real life? Obviously, you're not saying going 300 years in the future, but something that sparked it from your military or something that.
There's a lot of the military. There's a lot of me in that book.
Yeah.
For example, in the early chapters, when Kieran recognizes that he's in Australia and he has a memory of being there on a tour with a couple of British girls, I actually did that. I was in Australia in 1987 for the World Boy Scout Jamboree. So I was a Boy Scout at the time and went down there and spent about almost a month in Australia and New Zealand. And that was a memory. So it was something that I knew I wanted to do something with the setting and whatnot. I feel like I left a part of my heart in Australia. I'd love to go back at some point. And by doing so, by starting it there, I was able to tap into those memories because I've been to Mrs. Macquarie's chair. I've been there on Circular Quay. I've been through the Royal Botanical Gardens and that sort of thing. So it was fun to be able to start pulling that in. And then as you go through the rest of the book, there's a lot of different things, the different memory sequences that Kieran has and whatnot. That's a lot of my stuff. And it was fun to be able to put that in because you do that for a couple of reasons. You want to add depth to a scene, and you want to add some emotional resonance. But for me, it was also part of the story. You know, if you have someone that wakes up in the future like that and has essentially all their memories, but they're blocked and they have to experience different things to pull them out, how would that look? You know, I think I use a term or a phrase in the book that's kind of like scraps of paper and leaves, like fallen leaves blowing in the wind for him, because he'll see something and he can try to reach out and grab onto it. But until it really connects with his memory, it doesn't really make resonance with him. And by being able to do that and tie in some of those stories, I've really felt like it was something that I could get that emotional response out of. And it's something that continues now into all my writing. I mean, I'm 22 books deep into this career now, and it's fun to be able to have those moments and bring those things through, because our experiences as writers should be something that comes through in our work.
Sure. And when I read books, because I'm reading a lot these days, there's always something in the books. I say, okay, so let's see if I can figure out more about this author, you know, with their mindset, their mentality, with their integrity level or their sense of fitness of things, you know, because it definitely comes through. And because I was just curious about that, like, again, that one sequence when he tries to save, you know, it's just innate within him to want to save this other person. Everybody else stands by like, what are you doing? You know, and he has to like mobilize them into action.
Yeah.
I was wondering if that parallels your mindset and your philosophy of life.
Very much so. And that was actually something where I knew I needed in the course of the story to have those type of moments. And that one in particular goes back to all the years I spent as a lifeguard. I think I was a lifeguard from the time I was 14 to probably 25. I was a certified lifeguard. And yeah, it's something that we do as a lifeguard, and you know, having had that type of training and whatnot, you do those sorts of things without necessarily thinking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a response. You the stimulus happens, you respond in a trained manner. It's not like you're going to go out there flailing and do something bad. But in that particular case with Kieran, he sees this accident happen, and he knows he has to go. And he just reacts. And it's very similar to my own look at things. I mean, I can remember, I've witnessed car accidents and I'm out of the car and going to see if someone is okay and that sort of thing. It's just something that it's part of who you are. I mean, like I said, I was all the way through Boy Scouts. I was an Eagle Scout, all the way through my officer's training in the Army. I mean, all those things kind of come back to that. And it's an opportunity to not necessarily be the hero, but it's an opportunity to try to serve others and be helpful as much as you can and bring your skill set to bear. And in that particular case with that sequence, that's very much how I would look at that.
Yeah. And so how does Kentucky fit in with your
So it's actually Tennessee.
Yeah.
Tennessee. So I was born and raised in Johnson City, Tennessee.
Okay, good.
I am a Tennessean at heart. And so when Kieran goes home and when he discovers his ancestral homestead, that's actually based on our family farm. I have cousins that live there now. It's outside of Jonesboro, Tennessee. And that's home. And
wow.
Being able to go there, and it's been fun for them to get, you know, have the novel and whatnot, and know that, you know, where the old Rock Spring House is on the grounds, that's where Kieran goes, and it's fun. A few years ago, I think it was 2015. Yeah, 2015 or so, I was back in Tennessee with my dad, and we drove down to the farm, and I actually went outside. You know, it's kind of cool and misty, but I went outside and took a video, and, you know, had that opportunity to just kind of be there at that spot. And I mean, I'd been there, you know, millions of times as a kid.
Yeah.
But after you put it into a book and, you know, you make something of it, it kind of takes on a little bit different significance. So it was pretty cool to be able to do that.
Definitely. Now, are any of the characters in your book named after people in your life?
No, actually, they're not. So if you took Kieran's last name, would actually trace back through my mom's side of our family, because they were Rourkes, direct from Ireland. And then, of course, my dad's family was more Scotch-Irish. But no, there's no one that is actively named after someone. There's bits and pieces of names. So General Crawley, Crawley is the middle name of one of my closest friends and mentors. And so being able to pull him in a sense, in that respect, was a lot of fun. Berkeley Bennett, I actually admitted this to my daughter like 4 days ago. I'm not joking about this, because she wanted to know where did I come up with the name Berkeley. And I stole it from a waitress that I had at a restaurant in Utah. And it was while I was in the process of working on this book, and, you know, she comes up and introduces herself as Berkeley. It was just like this little tuning fork went off in my head. I'm like, I like that name. So I stole it. So
wow, that's great. So now, do you gravitate? I mean, I read all the different, you know, they're kind of like, it was a blur of everything that you've written here. So military sci-fi, Four Horsemen, that's military sci-fi. Yes. Protocol, obviously military sci-fi. Now, I know that Kane Riordan is also military sci-fi.
It's a much harder sci-fi, though.
It's definitely hard sci-fi, but it's definitely military, at least.
Yeah. And I would agree. I think, you know, mil sci-fi often gets the idea that it's, you know, just, you know, big guns and, you know, big explosions in space. And there's a whole lot more to it with
right.
the interactions of soldiers and leadership and that sort of thing. And then what Chuck's universe does with the Kane Riordan universe is it has those elements, but he's got a lot of intrigue, which I also like to write. He's got a lot of the hard science, which I'll admit, you know, I'm not the most scientific guy in the world, but there's certain concepts that are very intriguing, and being able to study them and get them right and put them into the universe is something fun to do. So I have gravitated a lot to those things, but I've also tried to do things where I can spread my chops out a little bit.
Yeah. Well, writing in the Eric Flint's universe, that's definitely a different set of cutlery.
It was
involved.
It was. And, you know, that story goes back to the notebook idea, you know, having a notebook around all the time when I was really starting out. And one point I wrote a note in that notebook about, what if the coin George Washington reputedly threw across the Delaware River was a bicentennial quarter? And I did nothing with that idea because I knew it was alternate history. And I'd read some Flint. I'd read some David Weber. I'd read some Harry Turtledove. I'd read Jeff and Michael Schara's work. That's more a little bit more historical fiction. But I had no clue what I was going to do with this. And so flash forward to 2014, right here at Superstars. I will go to the VIP dinner, and I'm sitting at Eric's table. We have a wonderful conversation all through the night, and he's asking a lot of questions about everyone. And at the end of the night, we're putting on our jackets, and we're getting ready to walk back here to the hotel. And I just kind of turned to him and blurted it out. I said, Eric, I have this idea. It's alternate history. I don't know what to do with it. Is it something where I can maybe get some direction from you on how to approach writing a story like this? And of course, you knew Eric as well as I did. He was one of my most cherished friends and mentors. And he, with his voice, what was the idea? So I tell him the idea with the coin that Washington reputedly threw, and his eyes light up. And he goes, let's go to lunch tomorrow. And so here I am, new author with you know, I'd finished the second manuscript I ever tried to write, which ended up being Sleeper Protocol, which it sold later that year. But here I was now going from this strange scribbled down idea in a notebook to now I'm going to talk with one of the masters of alternate history the next day at lunch about this story. And so that started my mentorship with Eric. And over the course of the next several years, we worked together on things. And it's kind of poignant to talk about the story, because the week after Superstars in 2014, I nearly died. I contracted an infection, which actually was a skin-eating bacterial infection that tried to eat my right leg. And so I spent time in the hospital here in Colorado Springs. It took me a long time to recover. As part of my recovery, I submitted the novel and ended up selling, which was fun because the first time I got a contract.
So I guess it has perks getting.
It did. It, I,
almost dying.
A little bit of time on your butt. And it was actually something where, you know, I'll be completely honest, dealing with the survivor's guilt, you know, because I knew from looking at the data from the Centers for Disease Control that over the course of the last several years prior to that, there'd only been a couple hundred thousand cases of what I had in the United States a year. And the mortality rate was fluctuating between 20 and 30%. So there was a 30% chance that I could have died. Mm-hmm. And so when you're recovering from something like that, you sometimes have those thoughts of, why am I still here? What about this is, you know, what am I supposed to be doing with this time that I've been given? And just one night I reached over and grabbed the computer and started and got back to work to get that manuscript ready and submit it out. So I did. And I got an offer from a small press. And one of the things that Eric used to do at Superstars was he would give a contracting class. And his promise to the group was, if you get a literary contract and it doesn't look right to you and you want a second set of eyes to look at it, send it to me. So I, being newbie author, you know, having met Eric, I send the nice polite email. Hey, Eric, did you really mean that what you said? And of course, Eric's like, send me the contract. So I send him the contract and he basically writes back with about, you know, it's like 5 pages of information about specific clauses. Don't sign this. Don't sign this. This is what they're looking for here. This one's okay, that sort of thing. And so I ended up turning down that contract. And it taught me enough that the second time I got a contract, I knew it was a good contract, but Eric was out of the country. So I ended up sending it to Kevin J. Anderson, who's also a good friend of mine, and said, hey, what do you think about this? And so I signed that contract. But I would never have imagined writing alternate history if it hadn't been for Eric's enthusiasm, because he loved the idea. And one of the things that he taught me at that very first lunch was actually down here in the hotel sports bar. I can show you the table too, if you'd like. He said, alternate history is not about the inciting incident. Everybody thinks it's you drop someone into the new future and the past and everything happens at that moment. It's not that. It's not just them coming back to the past. It's the ripples of everything that they touch. So everything that the protagonist or whoever is going to be in your book, everything that they do, even the clothes that they wear, have an effect. Because it's going to be so new to the time frame and their values, their approaches to things, their language, all that stuff is going to be so different that you have to explore those ripple effects. And so as we went through the construction and then when I wrote The Crossing, that was constantly on my mind. And then Eric as an editor was, you can imagine, gruff and direct.
Yep.
And he would be very, very upfront. This does not work, or I don't understand what you're doing here. And he really kind of reeled me back in a lot, because you get science fiction brain and everything is possible. And Eric would come back and say, go back a step, you know, go back and do this a little differently, because I think that you would see that, you know, just the appearance of shoes with rubber on the soles would really make colonial shoemakers wonder what's going on. But I would say, Eric, but there's no colonial shoemakers in the book. He said, that's not the point. What do other people see? How do they react to it? And he was right. There's a lot